The 1800s were a magical time in American history. It was an era of exploration, innovation, and making dreams come true. Advances in technology and medicine meant people were living longer, healthier lives. Telephones, railroads, and horseless carriages promised a future where the entire country could finally be connected. It was an incredible time to be alive, especially if you were an upper-class white man. The world was your oyster.
So different than now.
Right. Of course, women were still being arrested for the audacity of wearing pants, couldn't vote, and were legally considered the property of their fathers or husbands. But hey, still better than being a Native American or a person of color, for whom the same progress often meant displacement, violence, or worse. And yet, through all that change, through innovation, expansion, and so-called enlightenment, there was one constant, one thread that runs cleanly from the 1800s straight to today: politicians committing crimes and facing little to no consequences. Today, I bring you the story of a U.S. senator who faked his name, abandoned his family, got caught in multiple corruption scandals, and still got reelected 4 times. Welcome to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes.
History is messy,
weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're Rainy Day Rabbit Holes,
exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
Today, we're telling the story of John H. Mitchell. And this story has everything: politics, scandal, organ, fraud,
organ,
bigamy, mustaches. And as a bonus, it connects directly back to our most listened to episode ever, How the West Was Stolen, the Oregon Land Fraud King. Now, you might be wondering why that episode is our most popular. And the answer
is because
simple.
You did a really good job.
Well, thank you.
It's a great story.
Well, it also might be a little something to do with our special guest on that episode.
Don't sell yourself short.
Hey, I'm happy to ride her coattails.
Right? Hello, please let me.
Can you rub a little bit of that success on us, please, Allison? It was our friend Allison Gill, incredible podcaster, political analyst, and founder of the amazing MSW Media Network. And coinky dink, we just joined the MSW Media Network. Did you know that, Jody?
I'm like, I don't even know how to feel about it, because like, I've been a fangirl for so long.
Right?
And now I'm like, oh, I can't believe I'm included.
I know. It's so incredible.
It is.
So that means Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, this dumb history podcast.
Funny. Jeez Louise, you are
self-effacing
negative
this morning.
Talk.
That means Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, this amazing, funny, historical podcast.
Yes, exactly.
There we go. Is now joining the ranks of the Daily Beans, Clean Up on Aisle 45, Unjustified, and the Beans Talk, which is kind of surreal.
It's insane.
Yeah, that's insane. Like, that's Allison Gill.
Yeah.
We're part of her family now, her podcast family.
Yeah. Since it happened, I've been a little bit like, oh, is this real?
You know what other podcasts we're joining the ranks of?
What?
The Martin Sheen podcast.
That is like...
Martin Sheen.
I can't believe... Wow. I don't even know. I'm speechless. Like,
yeah. That's so... It's
to
so
be
cool.
Among the ranks of well-known, established, respected people.
Yeah.
Here we are.
What are we doing there?
Right?
Have they listened to this?
This is their, what is it? Their black sheep? Their,
yes.
The less classy of the family. I'm good with that.
That's fine. I'm fine being that little embarrassing member of the family that you're like, oh, I guess
you are the little sister. I'm sure you're used to it.
Yeah. Like, oh God, we have to invite Rainy Day Rabbit Holes.
How did we get connected to them again?
We're going to put them at the kids' table. They can't take part of this adult conversation.
Hey, I would be sitting at the kids' table feeling real proud.
So to celebrate, we decided to go back to that story and zoom in on one of its most fascinating characters. Now, if you haven't listened to How the West Was Stolen yet, I definitely recommend it. I remastered it and re-released it last week, so you don't even have to dig for it. And you can absolutely still enjoy today's episode on its own. But if you want the full experience, that earlier episode adds some context that makes this story hit a little bit harder. Okay, let's get into it. The subject of today's story, four-time U.S. Senator John Hipple Mitchell was, to put it mildly, a colorful character. He was born John Mitchell Hipple.
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 H-I-P-P-L-E. On June 22nd, 1835, in Washington County, Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
Look, we're back in Washington.
Yeah.
Counts.
Everywhere.
Now, I couldn't find a ton about his childhood, but what we do know is a few basics. His family moved to Butler, Pennsylvania in 1837.
How ironic, considering the day we recorded the original land fraud episode, that shooting was in Butler, Pennsylvania.
Was it really?
Yes.
I did not connect this.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes. Well, I'm going to confirm. It's Butler.
My mind is blown right now. Holy cow. What a crazy coincidence.
Yeah.
Nuts. Okay.
Stopped us in our tracks.
It did. Oh, and well, we need to give a little context because we talked about that in the introduction to last week's episode. We didn't actually talk about it yet on this episode.
Got it.
But just a little context for listeners so they understand why that's important is when we recorded the How the West Was Stolen episode with Allison Gill, in the middle of recording, Allison's phone starts blowing up because that was the day that Trump was shot at that rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. So it's a weird coincidence that's... Yeah. Big full circle here. Okay, so his family moved to Butler, Pennsylvania in 1837. He attended both public and private schools, including the Witherspoon Institute. Now, this was not the think tank that was founded in 2003. This is a Presbyterian prep school in Butler. And as a young man, he took up teaching. And this is where things immediately went off the rails.
He's teaching children, I assume.
I don't know if it's children or if he's teaching at a college.
Okay.
Not sure. Well, must be a high school because pretty early on, John became a family man in the sense that he impregnated his 15-year-old student, Sarah Hoon. Because it was the 1800s, the solution to this crime that wasn't a crime in the 1800s was, of course, marriage. That was it. That was the consequence. Really getting off to a strong moral start here.
Yeah.
Sarah and John went on to have two children. And around this same time in 1857, John began practicing law. By all accounts, John was not happy in the marriage. I'm sure it had nothing to do with the fact that it limited his ability to philander at will.
Did it, though? I mean, he can do whatever he wants.
True. But if he was unhappy, Sarah was unquestionably worse off. Mm. According to the Oregonian, Mitchell beat and maltreated his wife so severely that he was indicted by a grand jury and brought to trial.
Wow.
This
even
was the
back
1800s,
then. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And despite what the paper described as a mountain of evidence against him, Mitchell managed to convince Sarah to settle the matter privately, and the case was dismissed. So once again, consequences avoided.
Free to go about his fraud and business.
That's right. Can't hold John back. Eventually, John decided he was done with this whole husband and father situation altogether. Despite having established a successful law practice, he apparently got itchy feet because in 1860, he took off for San Luis Obispo, California, with a local school teacher he was having an affair with, leaving Sarah and their children penniless. What an upstanding man.
He should become a president. Just kidding.
This is definitely politician material. Oh, and as a fun bonus detail, he also stole roughly $4,000 from his law clients on the way out, leaving behind a mountain of debt.
Whoa, $4,000?
Yeah.
And
how much is that?
1860, let me look. $156,000.
Oh, yeah, that's nothing to laugh at, right? That's
he
nothing
stole
to sneeze
that.
At. Yeah.
Roughly from $156,000 to $2.5 million. There's quite a range, but either way.
Well, let's go with the lower one.
Yeah.
That's a
thanks,
weird
Google.
Thanks. That was very
so helpful.
That was clear as mud.
I want my $156,000 to be, you know, same thing as $2.5 million.
Right. But no matter, it was time to chase dreams. In California, obviously. California, however, didn't turn out to be the promised land. Mitchell quickly abandoned Maria J. Brinker, the woman he'd run off with, and moved on again, this time to Portland, Oregon. Unfortunately for Maria, she'd become ill, and John had no intention of caring for her or paying for her medical bills.
Oh, wow.
What a guy. What a catch. And because it was the 1800s, we know absolutely nothing about what happened to Maria after that. She just disappears from the record.
Yeah.
Of course, her reputation is ruined. She's in a completely different state by herself.
Dumped
sick,
off.
And alone. Dumped. And in the 1800s, a woman that has been treated like that, it's obviously her fault. So...
Right. So let her live in her consequences.
Right. Mm-hmm. The only lingering detail is that Mitchell appears to have taken his oldest daughter with him when he headed north to Oregon. And from there, he would begin the next phase of his life, reinvention. Once in Portland, Mitchell set about constructing his brand new life. And the first order of business? A fresh start, complete with a new name. He swapped his middle and last names and began calling himself John Hipple Mitchell instead of John Mitchell Hipple. And then went around town telling everybody that he was a widower from Pittsburgh.
Wow.
And that his wife had recently died in San Francisco.
Wow.
So problem solved. Clean slate. Fresh start.
Wow.
Now, all that pesky wife, kids, and mistress business was supposedly behind him. And so John was finally ready to move on. On February 25th, 1862, he married Miss Hattie Price of Portland.
So we're on number three, wife.
Maria Brinker was just a mistress.
Oh, got it.
Yeah. So he married Hattie 2 years after he left Sarah.
Okay.
Except, whoops, he forgot something.
He forgot to divorce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He forgot to get divorced.
Well, when you just wipe them off the record and keep moving.
Out of sight, out of mind. They don't count.
Oops. So I'm anticipating no consequences for this, but continue on.
It's like you've read my story.
It is the 1860s and he's a white man.
Right.
I mean, what a great time to be a white man.
Right. It wouldn't be until 1869, 7 years later, that Sarah finally tracked him down and sued for divorce, officially ending a marriage Mitchell had apparently decided no longer applied to him. So during his first few years in Oregon, John rebuilt his law practice and quickly ingratiated himself into Portland's power structure, eventually becoming Portland's city attorney. And since he was such an upstanding, ethical man, there were no scandals, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, not any that he would see consequences for.
Very true. Old Slippery John was right back to his old tricks. And more importantly, he was setting patterns that would follow him for the rest of his career and life. The case that really captures this moment, the one that made legal history, the one that's still taught in law schools today, is Pennoyer versus Neff, decided in 1877. Now, we are going to get into the details of that case because it perfectly illustrates how Mitchell approached both law and politics. But before we disappear down that particular rabbit hole, let's take a quick break. That's me hopping like a rabbit.
Oh, I thought you were riding a horse.
Same thing. Oh, and hey, did you know we have a Patreon?
What? Of course I know. We
That's
have
right.
great patrons in our Patreon.
That's how you got such a good butt. It's because of the Patreon. Because
I'm a member. Yes.
What was the hair loss ad from like the 90s? Not only am I its president, I'm a client.
Yes. That's me with our Patreon.
If you want more unhinged history and six-pack abs, consider becoming a supporter. For as little as $5 a month, you get bonus content and ad-free episodes. So hop on over to rainydayrabbitholes.com to sign up. All right. So Marcus Neff was a young pioneer who set off from Iowa in early 1848 to seek his fortune on the West Coast. The 24-year-old joined a wagon train, like so many others, hoping to take advantage of the vast tracts of land. Sorry.
Okay.
Have you seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Parts of it.
So there's this whole skit, and it's like medieval times, and this like lord is marrying off his son to this woman, and this woman has giant breasts,
but he
would say something about her and her huge, and he'd hold his hands out like breasts, but then he'd say tracts of land. So that's why it's huge. Tracts of land.
Got it. Got it. The reference made.
So he was hoping to take advantage of the huge tracts of land that would become available once Oregon achieved statehood. So Neff was among the earliest settlers to claim land under the Oregon Donation Act. But here's the catch. Under that law, you had to be a citizen living in Oregon and submit your claim by December 1st, 1850. Neff didn't submit his claim until December 15th. Small problem. But someone helpfully crossed out December and wrote in September.
It's only a small problem.
So fraud right out of the gate. Now, registering a land claim at that time required a mountain of paperwork, including two affidavits from disinterested parties swearing that the applicant was improving the land for personal, not commercial use. So go back to our old episode and you'll hear more about like all of this, much more detail about this process. Yeah. These affidavits were supposed to be submitted 4 years after the original claim. So Neff submitted his affidavits too early in 1853 and then resubmitted them in 1856. Even so, thanks to good old government red tape, he didn't receive his official land patent for another 10 years. Now, this will be important.
So 66. We're at 1866.
Now. Right. Mm-hmm. Which brings us to 1862. So in the middle of this process, when Neff made a truly unfortunate decision, he hired a lawyer to help speed things along. And who do you think he hired? Do you already forget the name of our hero of our story?
In my head, he's Mr. Pimple.
For some reason. John H. Mitchell. Now, Mitchell was an upstanding and ethical lawyer, right? So there's no way he would take advantage of the fact that his new client was illiterate. Absolutely not.
No.
Mitchell did file paperwork on Neff's behalf in 1862, and Neff soon received confirmation from the government that he had met the criteria for his patent. So remember, back then, it was the land claim deed was called a patent at the time, not a deed, just to not get confused here. Neff paid Mitchell $6.50 for the work, but Mitchell claimed he was actually owed another $209, which is about $6,500 today. So Neff thinks that he's paid him just to file some paperwork for him. And Mitchell's like, no, I did a bunch of legal work for you. $6,500.
Wow.
And instead of pursuing that claim immediately, Mitchell waited. He waited until Neff left the state. Then on November of 1865, so 3 years later, Mitchell filed suit against him for $253.14 plus costs. Now, here's where things get interesting. Under Oregon law, if a defendant couldn't be found in the state, they could be served by publication, meaning you could sue someone by printing a notice in the newspaper. Wow. So if I can't find you.
So what if this newspaper, is it like, does it have to be like a, if it's a local newspaper and he's left the area? Oh, got you.
Mitchell filed an affidavit stating that Neff was somewhere in California and couldn't be located. He didn't explain what efforts he made to find him. Just couldn't be done. Mm-hmm. So Mitchell placed a notice in the newspaper, specifically the Pacific Christian Advocate, a weekly Methodist publication focusing on religious news.
Went out to a whole 50 people.
Right.
There are 50 copies printed.
All the congregants of that one church.
Mm-hmm.
A newspaper that Neff was definitely reading wherever he was in California.
Yeah, for sure.
But it was a publication in a newspaper. Neff never responded. Shocking, I know. So on February 19th, 1866, a default judgment of $294.98 was entered against him. Now, Mitchell could have executed the judgment immediately. But remember how that land patent didn't get to Neff until 1866? Mitchell waited a few months, just long enough for that land patent to finally come through. Now, interestingly, while Mitchell claimed that he couldn't find Neff, the Oregon land office apparently had no trouble finding him at all.
So the land office found him.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering how he was going to ever like
know that he got this patent. Yeah. No.
Right. Or even like get. So he's suing him for money, but he can't find him. So how are you going to get your money?
Because the judgment against him, then he can
take
do
the
this.
Take the, yes. Okay.
So Mitchell then posted a notice of sheriff's auction, and in August of 1866, Neff's land was sold for $341.60. The buyer, none other than J.H. Mitchell himself. Mm-hmm. A few days later, Mitchell assigned the property to Sylvester Pennoyer, another lawyer and real estate speculator. For the next 8 years, Pennoyer paid the taxes on the land, cut timber, and sold off a few small parcels. And then in 1874, Marcus Neff reappeared.
And he's clueless at this point.
Well, now he's figured it out. Right. So Neff did go off to California, mm-hmm. and he actually became very successful, had a wife and kids, and had a lot of money. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when he figured out what was going on with this land, he decided to come back. He moved his whole family back to Oregon.
Back. He didn't just visit.
No, he moved back to Oregon for a year so that he could deal with this case. So he filed suit, and the case eventually made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled in his favor. Now, Pennoyer was evicted from the land, and he tried to recover the property taxes he paid and other money that he had spent improving the land up. But Neff counterclaimed for the value of the timber and the land that had been sold off.
Yeah,
he's like,
for sure.
This was not legal the way this was taken. Yeah. Also, when Mitchell originally filed suit back in 1865, he claimed that Neff owned the land at that time, but the land patent had not come through. So there was all of this legal, you know, muddying of the waters.
It's all in limbo. So where's the line?
So they ruled in Neff's favor. He was the one who was originally wronged. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Pennoyer was a victim of this, and he walked away with nothing in the end.
Did he profit off of the timber he sold or anything?
Yeah, but I don't know how much of that ended up going into legal fees and in the end, how much did he actually lose? How much? Mm-hmm. So, but he had no compensation from it. Just this very expensive lesson. But he didn't do too badly in life for himself. He went on to serve 2 terms as governor of Oregon and 1 term as mayor of Portland. But he never forgot how he ended up there. And he carried a grudge against John H. Mitchell for the rest of his life.
I would too.
Yeah.
That's dirty deeds.
You know, I know that was a lot of a side quest, but that is just kind of to set the tone for the way John Mitchell lives his life. So you've seen how he treats people in his personal life. You've seen how he treats people in his professional life. And now, while all this was going on, John was also very busy pursuing a political career.
Of course he was.
So he was first elected to the Oregon State Senate in 1862. And by 1864, he had risen to become president of the Senate, a position he held until 1866, which is pretty impressive.
So he's doing all of this while he's frauding.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Especially considering everything he had going on, he was able to reach these pretty lofty heights in local politics, in state politics. According to Sin, Scandal, and Substantive Due Process by Wendy Collins Perdue, there's a line that perfectly captures what people were already starting to think about John Mitchell. His political methods are indeed pitched on a sufficiently low scale, but not below his methods as a lawyer. That line sticks with us, not just because of that one case, but because it speaks to a style, a pattern, a way Mitchell seemed to move through the world, regardless of whether he was practicing law, running for office, or reinventing his personal life. Unsurprisingly, his political career was just as full of scandal and strife as his marriage history and law practice. And the first real warning sign came early, in 1866, during what historians now call the Bolting Caucus.
The Bolting?
Bolting. At the time, Oregon Republicans met in caucus to decide who the party would back for U.S. Senator. And that decision was supposed to be binding. The caucus selected Governor Addison C. Gibbs, not John H. Mitchell. And that should have settled it, but it didn't. A small group of Republican legislators flat out refused to go along. They bolted the caucus, broke party discipline, and voted their own way, blowing up the Republican majority and throwing the election into chaos. In the end, the seat didn't even go to Gibbs or Mitchell at all. It went to Henry W. Corbett, a man who hadn't even been the caucus's choice.
Oh, wow.
What made the episode infamous wasn't just the loss. It was the damage it did. From that moment on, caucus loyalty in Oregon Republican politics was never quite the same. And Mitchell's name was permanently tied to that damage.
I'm speechless.
This came back to haunt him.
Yeah, that's...
Well, not really haunt him. None of this really haunted him until the very end.
Right.
It would come back to bug him, basically.
Bug him, yeah.
He wasn't haunted by it.
Right. And why would he be?
It was just an inconvenience to him when this would come back. Because, yes, this guy escaped consequences for his whole life.
Right. And he's got this ego. He's narcissistic. He's...
It's
awful. So,
even though Mitchell didn't win the seat, many Republicans believe the bolt had happened because of him, because he had encouraged it, engineered it, or at least stood back and benefited from that chaos. Mm-hmm. Newspapers and political rivals began describing him not as a party man, but as a political disruptor, someone willing to fracture his own side if it moved him closer to power. Some things never change.
Right, I'm speechless because it's not nice to
say. The Bolting Caucus gave Mitchell a reputation that would follow him for decades. A man who didn't just bend the rules, but treated them as optional. Sound familiar?
Yep.
A politician who understood that in Oregon, you didn't need to command a majority. You just needed to control a handful of defections.
All you need is your mind and your morality to guide you.
Yep. And when your morality is basically the stuff that grows underneath your bathroom drain, shower drain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the stuff that's the black stuff.
Yeah. So weird. I just cleaned the drains yesterday. So that's the timing. It's fresh in my mind.
I need to go home and clean my shower. In 1866, Mitchell failed to win re-election in the state Senate. And part of it the reason was this Bolting Caucus.
Yeah.
Right. So he had put in this bid for state Senate and they were like, yeah, no, no. But not to worry. He wasn't aiming small anymore. His sights were set on a much bigger prize. In 1872, he was elected as a Republican to the United States Senate, where he served until 1878, when he lost his bid for re-election. But almost immediately, Mitchell's long history of, let's just call them choices, began catching up with him. Just 3 months after being sworn in as Oregon's U.S. Senator, the dam broke. Stories began finally circulating about his name change, his adultery, his marriage to a 15-year-old student, his bigamy, embezzlement, and his deeply shady law practice. At the same time, accusations of corruption and bribery were swirling, and this time they weren't vague. One name kept coming up over and over again, Ben Holliday. Holliday wasn't just another wealthy supporter. He was the railroad king of Oregon. And I'm going to do a story about him. He was the railroad king, the stagecoach king, the like, you name it king. He was one of these oligarchs that was just insanely wealthy, insanely powerful, wildly influential, and deeply embedded in the state politics, of course.
Right.
So he was going to direct politics in a way that was always beneficial to him.
Right, right. Still corrupt. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen today at all, does it?
No, I'm so glad they've solved that problem. Yeah.
And Mitchell was his legal advisor. Mitchell's enemies
<That's> wise.
claimed that Holliday hadn't merely supported his Senate run, that he had bought it. According to those accusations, Holliday had paid Mitchell somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000. That's roughly $400,000 to $550,000 today to secure the Senate seat.
It was cheap back then.
Yeah. I know.
How many millions did it take? Oh, I guess that was a presidency, so it probably takes more money.
Yeah, a little more than a U.S. Senate seat. Yeah, exactly. It's good. You got to scale it up. So that's not just casual corruption. That's purchasing power on an industrial scale. Mm-hmm. One opponent claimed Mitchell had summed up the relation perfectly when he declared, and this is supposedly Mitchell's own words, "Whatever is Ben Holliday's politics is my politics. And whatever Ben Holliday wants, I want."
Wow.
Whatever Elon
bootlickers, wants. bootlickers of the past.
Right? Just substitute Elon Musk in this for Ben Holliday.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was just thinking.
A U.S. Senate committee looked into the allegations. And Oregon's aggressive U.S. attorney, Addison Gibbs, opened a formal investigation and sought indictments. The evidence was very strong. The accusations were detailed. The stakes were enormous. And yet, the grand jury declined to indict. Gibbs suspected the jurors themselves had been bribed. Mm-hmm. So he pushed for another attempt. That attempt, of course, went nowhere. By this point, Mitchell had accumulated a truly impressive amount of leverage and influence, and he used it. According to private diaries of federal judge Matthew Detty, Mitchell traded his Senate vote to help George H. Williams, the U.S. Attorney General and a fellow Oregonian, in exchange for shutting the investigation down. Williams ordered Gibbs to back off. Gibbs refused. So Williams fired him. And just like that, the investigation collapsed. Nothing new under the sun, right?
Nope.
Once again, John H. Mitchell walked away without consequences, which was by now becoming a familiar pattern.
Right, right. How old is he by now? We're in the 70s.
He was born in 35, and this was 1872-ish, somewhere around there.
So he's still
a fairly young man.
Yeah.
40s. Mm-hmm. Mitchell ran for re-election again in 1882 and lost. But this was John H. Mitchell here. So, of course, that wasn't the end of the story. In 1885, he managed to claw his way back into the U.S. Senate once again, with his earlier Good scandals grief. Still very much trailing behind him. In the lead up to the election, the Oregonian published an expose detailing Mitchell's early life and long record of corruption, and then added a little extra spice by printing love letters Mitchell had written to his current wife's younger sister, Carrie Price.
Oh my gosh.
Nice. Nevertheless, this is doing a lot of work here. Mitchell was elected, sworn in, and went on to serve two more terms in the Senate. For now.
What was his selling point? How does he get people to go ahead and vote for him?
He was somebody who was very charming.
That's what I was thinking, is here we are with the cult of personality.
Very much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Had a good, a strong handshake and a good smile, and he knew how to talk the talk.
His charm and personality outweighed all of his dirty deeds that were actually part of his personality.
You know, there were, I read a lot of newspaper articles from the late 1800s. Some were very critical of him, and then some were just glowing with praise. And so I think he was able to, you know, manipulate public, public sentiment to his favorite by probably coloring his detractors as just beings, people who were trying to grab power and, you know, do the accusing the opposition of everything that he actually was doing.
Yeah.
And it's the 1800s. You don't have information at your fingertips.
Right. Well, and everything we do now is documented somewhere online.
It's a lot easier and he was the type of person that would burn letters.
Right.
You know,
right.
He did not want a paper trail.
Right. Right. I mean, we don't Until do anything without a paper trail. We don't, you know, we can't buy anything. You know what I mean? It's
we're
trailed. Yeah. Well, I mean,
as usual, accusations of corruption followed closely behind. Once again, Ben Holliday, the railroad king, loomed in the background, still reaching his dirty fingers into Oregon politics. Mitchell was accused of orchestrating payoffs, allegedly financed by the Southern Pacific Railroad Company, to 17 Democratic legislators in exchange for their votes. But once again, no charges were filed. Once again, our slippery senator wiggled right through.
So not surprised.
Nope. Mitchell sought re-election yet again in 1897, and yet again managed to set off a political crisis, this time in the 19th Oregon Legislative Assembly. Although he was unanimously nominated by Republican legislators for U.S. Senator, Mitchell had become deeply unpopular with large portions of the broader legislature. His opponents, including longtime enemy Henry W. Corbett, who still believed Mitchell had secured his 1873 Senate seat through corruption, decided to fight him procedurally instead of electorally. They split the House into two factions and refused to organize. Members skipped roll calls. They refused to convene. They deliberately prevented the House from reaching the quorum required to conduct business. So this is all to try to block him. That's how bad he was.
Yeah.
The result? The legislature could do nothing at all, not even elect a senator. So Oregon was left with a vacant U.S. Senate seat for more than a year.
Wow. For their state. This is a U.S. senator?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they get two each. Oh, man.
So eventually, in a special session in 1898, one of Mitchell's opponents, Joseph Simon, was elected to the Senate, finally ending the deadlock. And surprisingly, after three stints in the U.S. Senate, decades of scandal, and a reputation that preceded him everywhere he went, John H. Mitchell still wasn't done. His biggest and final scandal was still ahead after this quick break.
We've needed term limits forever.
He has been in the Senate for so long.
Who is that one? Oh, is it Strom Decades. Thurmond? Jesus. As long as him. I think he was in it for like 60, 50, 70 years. God.
Yeah, we need term
almost
limits.
Since the beginning.
You should have 8 years tops and you're done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at this point, Mitchell had been a state senator, president of the state Senate, and had already served 3 times as U.S. senator. And he still wasn't done. After losing his seat to Joseph Simon in 1898, he returned to private law practice, which, given what we know about him by now, probably should have made everyone a little nervous.
Right.
And then, in 1901, he staged one last political resurrection. After 40 days of legislative deadlock, exhausted lawmakers, and endless maneuvering, John H. Mitchell won a 4th term in the United States Senate.
Good grief.
He never goes away.
This must have been something that benefited him greatly for him to keep at this.
Well, yeah, he's amassed all this power.
Yeah, yeah. He's
an influence. Yeah. So, and this is the time of timber barons and railroad magnates and land prospectors. Like, he's probably making money hand over fist in bribes.
Insane.
His return to the Senate roughly coincided with the election of my favorite president, President Theodore Roosevelt. And that mattered because up until this point, Mitchell had mostly operated in a political system that looked the other way. And Roosevelt would not look the other way. Roosevelt was a progressive reformer. He believed the federal government had a responsibility to step in when powerful interests abused the system. He called it the square deal: conservation of natural resources, regulation of corporations, and protection of consumers.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing Roosevelt cared deeply about was public land. Land that was supposed to belong to the American people, not quietly siphoned off to speculators and timber companies. The Oregon land fraud was theft on a massive scale.
Yeah.
Now, if you want a deep dive on how it worked, you should absolutely go back and listen to our Oregon land fraud episode that we re-released last week. But here's the short version. For decades, Congress had passed laws like the Homestead Act, the Timber and Stone Act, to encourage settlement. The deal was simple. Live on the land, improve it, follow the rules, and eventually you own it. But by the late 1800s, land speculators and timber interests had figured out how to break that deal without technically breaking the law, at least on paper.
Mm-hmm.
They recruited dummy entrymen, people paid to file land claims they never intended to live on. Sometimes they'd literally head down to the docks, round up sailors, march them to the courthouse, and pay them $10 each to file fraudulent claims. And then they'd go off on their ships. Once the federal government approved the claim, the land was transferred to timber interests. Multiply that by thousands of claims, and suddenly millions of acres of public land were gone.
Swooped up.
Yep.
By the greedy railroad.
And timber barons. And people mining. So remember when we talked about that? We talked about the same sort of thing happened in the more deserty states in Nevada, Arizona, California for mineral rights.
Mm-hmm.
When this finally reached Theodore Roosevelt's desk in 1904, he didn't ignore it. He ordered the Justice Department to tear the entire operation open. And that's where John H. Mitchell re-entered the story, not as a lawmaker shaping policy, but as a lawyer with access. Mitchell continued practicing law while serving as a U.S. senator, and some of his clients were involved in fraudulent land claims. That should be illegal. You shouldn't be able to be a lawyer and a senator because the conflict of interest is just too much.
Right. A practicing lawyer. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
According to sworn testimony, Mitchell accepted a $2,000 payment from land fraud operator Stephen Pewter to use his influence with the General Land Office to advance fraudulent claims. Mitchell denied taking the bribes. He insisted he had merely helped constituents navigate federal bureaucracy, something senators have done for decades. But this time, the people running the land fraud did not stay silent. Stephen Pewter, the self-titled Oregon land fraud king, had already been convicted by the time investigators reached Mitchell. So Pewter flipped. He talked and he named names. And at the top of that list was John H. Mitchell. In 1904, Mitchell was indicted. In 1905, he went on trial, while still serving as a United States senator. It became one of the most sensational trials in Oregon history. The case centered on the payments made to Mitchell, and the testimony cut deep. His law partner and his private secretary both took the stand against him.
Wow.
On July 3rd, 1905, the jury returned its verdict. Guilty.
Ooh.
John H. Mitchell was convicted of bribery and conspiracy while still serving as a U.S. senator. He was sentenced to 6 months in jail, fined $1,000, and effectively disbarred. I mean, he faced consequences, sort of, kind of.
Right, right.
He filed an appeal.
Oh, golly.
And for a brief moment, it looked like he might once again slip his way past the consequences. But this time, he didn't. In December 1905, before his appeal was resolved, John Hipple Mitchell died in Portland, reportedly from complications following a dental procedure.
Wow.
The response in Washington was subdued. There was no grand eulogy, no heroic send-off. When the Senate adjourned...
No flag at half-mast.
Right. Jeez. When the Senate adjourned, the chaplain offered a prayer that referenced corruption, a quiet but unmistakable acknowledgement of how Mitchell's career had ended. Later, the Senate approved payment of his funeral expenses. And that was the end. John Mitchell didn't fall because the system suddenly grew a set of morals. He fell because, for once, the system stopped pretending not to see the corruption. And that's what makes his story feel so modern. Not the crimes themselves, but how long they were tolerated.
Yeah.
Mitchell wasn't undone by one bad act. He was undone by a lifetime of them.
And how undone, really? I mean, he lived an entire life getting, you know, doing what he wanted, gaining all sorts of, you know, money, property, power.
Right. And if he hadn't died,
right,
he probably would have gotten that appeal through and had his conviction overturned. And he would have gone right back to practicing law. Maybe he wouldn't have gone back to politics, but that doesn't mean that his influence and power was gone. He would still know who to talk to. And he probably had people's secrets, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's not above blackmail.
Right.
We've seen what his morals and ethics were.
Absolutely. So there's a hero dentist somewhere in Oregon.
That was like, I'm doing this procedure without washing my hands. Because that's for commies or something. I don't know. This was early 1900s.
Let me go
I don't
clean
know
up happening. This cow poop first.
I'm going to go and autopsy a body with no gloves and then go right to you.
Yes. Open wide.
That's what they used to say to mothers giving birth. I've come from this autopsy open wide.
Uh-huh.
Which is why so many people died in childbirth. Or after childbirth. Okay, where was I?
Hero dentist. No.
Because corruption doesn't live in the past. It just changes costumes.
Yep, yep.
And as we start sharing more stories like this with the MSW Media Network, alongside voices like Allison Gill, we're going to keep pulling on these threads. Not because history repeats itself exactly, but there sure isn't anything new under the sun.
Yep, yep.
And that's the story of... our slippery senator from Oregon.
Oregon. From liver.
I did a good job
you
this
did
time.
A really good job.
Oregon. I just have to remember with that E in there.
Yeah, the E.
It's not
yeah.
Oregon. It's Oregon.
Good
Oregon.
Job.
So that's our slippery senator from Oregon, John Hipple Mitchell.
Oh, how things have never changed. Right? So much has changed and so much not changed. I mean, so many times I was like, I could see you look at me like, are you going to say something? And
I'm like,
I can't. Like, I'm stunned that we are still doing this same thing.
Exact thing.
And it's so bad.
With
it's
just not, less social media.
Yeah. It's
that's all
it's
it is.
So bad. Why do we continue this? And how have we not figured it out? Term limits, though, I feel like.
If this was today, this guy would have had his conviction overturned, or he would have been pardoned. He would have gone on to become a podcaster.
Yeah.
And then he would have been...
Secretary of something
installed in the cabinet.
Yep, yep. I mean, he's an ideal.
He would have been the Secretary of Land Management.
There you go. Absolutely, and there's no problem with that.
Exactly. You'll be like, you are supremely qualified because you did a lot of fraud in the land sector, so you should be in charge of land management because you know exactly how to help those frauds along.
Ideal candidate.
Yes. So yeah, it's. This is a story I've been wanting to do for a while. when we did that episode with Allison, she said, I think you need to dive deeper into the story. I think you need to write a book about this and do a limited series about this, which sounded great at the time, but it's also a lot of work.
Right. The ambition.
Maybe I need to now that I've got the base started. I could get into all of these characters. Well,
right. That's true. Over time, you might end up doing that if you keep covering these.
I know. Well, and my thought is like, what it needs to happen is I need to do the series on the railroad, because the railroad was at the heart of a lot of this corruption and scandal. Yeah. They wielded so much power in the 1800s that they basically ran the government. So
they ran communities, they ran city. Yeah, they ran everything.
And the things that's interesting is these companies are still exist today.
Yeah.
So a lot of them have consolidated, but railroad still is integral to our economy. And so it's very interesting. Like, this is something that has been going on since the mid-1800s, is that railroad is integral to our economy. Mm-hmm. And so that would be an interesting thread to follow all the way through. Maybe that's season two is the railroad. Because, man, there's corruption.
Yeah.
So much corruption.
Right.
Death? Murder?
Yeah. It's insane the amount.
Yeah.
Yeah. That they got away with forever. Openly got away with forever.
Yeah. Anyway, before we close up, I would like to say a huge thank you to Allison Gill. Thank you so much, not just for joining us on that episode in 2024, How the West Was Stolen, but for being such a generous, thoughtful voice in this space. And we're genuinely honored to be joining the MSW Media Network alongside all these shows that we've admired for such a long time. So thank you so much, Allison. We really appreciate it. And if this is your first time listening because you found us through MSW, welcome. And we're really glad you're here. If you want more Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, head on over to rainydayrabbitholes.com. You'll find all of our episodes there, plus links to our Patreon, where supporters get bonus content and ad-free episodes. You can also find us on YouTube and on social media. Follow us, share the show, and if you like this episode, please tell a friend. That honestly helps more than you know. And a quick shout out to the people who make the show look and function the way it does. Our website was designed by Letha Davis at easybreezy.com. That's EASYBRZY. And our social media is managed by Logan Hine at Redemption Industries. We couldn't do this without them. And as always, thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting independent podcasts. And thank you for going down this rabbit hole with us. We'll see you next time.
See you down the rabbit hole.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.